Hello, this is Wendy Bauer reading to you today from the Decatur Herald and Review, September 18th, 2017. And we will begin today's reading on the front page with the article headlined, Runners Around Lake Decatur, Shoreline Classic Takes 28th Trip Around Nelson Park. Ryan Voiles writes from Decatur, Sunday marked one more step for John Daniels to catching the running bug. The Decatur residents and hundreds of others took to Nelson Park early Sunday morning to take part in the 28th annual Shoreline Classic, which drew over 1,000 runners and spectators from across the country. The race offers a combination of a 15K run, a 5K run walk, and a tot trot for the youngest runners, all around a scenic track along the shores of Lake Decatur. Proceeds for the classic go to fund local and high school running programs. For Daniels, it was the second 5K he's done this year. His wife has the running bug, and Daniels said he saw running alongside her a good way to strengthen their relationship. The running, in addition to a change in his diet, has led Daniels to lose almost 50 pounds in the past 4 months, to the point where he said his neighbor did not recognize him anymore. I just had a neighbor who thought I was the son of me, he said with a laugh. She didn't realize it was me. Other newcomers, like Sandra Munoz, were just looking for a new challenge. I was getting tired of doing the tot trot, said the 7-year-old, who was one of several siblings to partake in the classic. Runners first started to descend upon Nelson Park just after 6 a.m., with more than 600 registered to run in the 15K and 5K. There are a variety of reasons they choose to come to the Classic, said race director John Pranchke, which includes the scenic view, post-race award ceremony, and party at the Nelson Park Pavilion and the opportunity to run in a 15K. I've never heard of another 15K in the Midwest, Pranchke said. The 15K was one of the things that brought Lake Forest's Eva Sosnowska down to Decatur this weekend. As she trains to run a half marathon, Sosnowska said the Shoreline Classic provided a nice opportunity to work her way up to longer races and to support local race. It's pretty well known, and I wanted to support Illinois races as opposed to traveling elsewhere, she said. Hillary Tu of New Jersey finished first in the men's 15K with a time of 44:59, while Monica Gieg of Michigan took first in the women's 15K with a time of 51:35. Mark Bottenhorn of Colorado took first in the men's 5K with a time of 17:41, while Erica Holroyd of Missouri took first in the women's 5K with a time of 19:50. Daniels eventually finished the 5K with a time of 32:22, which put him 132nd of 326 runners in the race. His ultimate goal is to catch up to his wife, though he jokes that it may take some time. She's doing the 15K today, and I'm doing the 5K, he said. I'm not that close yet. And photographs accompanying the article. One shows people lined up at the starting line, all ages, really, from quite young to middle age, runners for the Shoreline Classics 5K race, line up at the starting line on Sunday morning at Nelson Park. There are also a couple of photographs. Volunteers cheer on runners from the Shoreline Classics 15K race as they cross the finish line on Sunday morning. And a photograph of Hillary Tu being the first to cross the finish line for the Shoreline Classics 15K race. Beautiful picture along the shoreline with the lake in the background. Also from the front page, an article headlined, Legislators Take Leave. More than 20 state lawmakers resign, say they won't run again. Illinois residents aren't the only ones throwing up their hands at the gridlock and increasingly polarized politics that have defined state government in recent years. More and more, fed up and frustrated Illinois legislators are heading for the exits. More than two dozen legislators, about 15% of the General Assembly, have either resigned months into the current session or said they won't seek re-election. They are Democrats and Republicans, rank-and-file moderates, and those in leadership posts, including House Majority Leader Barbara Flynn Curry, who said last week that she's ending her nearly 40-year legislative career when her term expires. It's an exodus that longtime State House observers say is unusual, not just for the high number of lawmakers leaving, but for the reasons many legislators are giving. Frustration with not being able to reach compromises, the stress of the two-year budget impasse that only recently ended, year-round campaigning, and a public that's grown more hostile and vocal. There is a toxic environment. People seem to not be able to get along even outside of the Capitol, said retiring Republican State Rep. Steve Anderson. That's not a good environment, and that's not an environment I want to be part of. Anderson received hate mail and even a death threat after he and about a dozen other Republicans broke with GOP Governor Bruce Rauner to support a deal to end the budget stalemate that included an income tax increase. He also lost his position as the GOP's House floor leader. A short time later, he announced he isn't running again. Turnover in government isn't new, nor are politics that many may find distasteful, particularly in Illinois. Several governors have gone to prison, and multiple public opinion polls have found Illinois residents are especially distrustful of their government. But what's happened in recent years has been different, as a standoff dragged on between Rauner, a multimillionaire former businessman, and longtime Democratic legislative leaders, namely House Speaker Michael Madigan. With the two sides unable to agree on a budget, social service agencies and universities suffered while the state racked up billions in unpaid bills. The 2016 legislative elections featured several bruising contests, including primary challenges bankrolled largely by Rauner and his wealthy friends, and labor unions determined to stop his anti-union agenda. As the fights stretched into 2017, more and more lawmakers started issuing resignation letters. Some are running for other offices, from water reclamation district commissioner to governor, though many say the job isn't fun anymore, said Mike Lawrence, who has worked in and around state government for 50 years. My sense is we've never seen anything quite like this, Lawrence said. I worry it's becoming a trend. Many of those calling it quits are Republicans like Anderson, who helped Democrats override Rauner's veto of the budget deal. They have either grown weary or see a primary challenge coming from those angered by the tax hike. In his resignation letter, GOP State Rep. Chad Hayes said dislike and distrust between Rauner and Madigan has paralyzed government in Illinois. Ego, money, and power eclipse the desire of well-meaning and honest public servants, Hayes wrote. Blame, press conferences, and talking points have replaced governing. Voices of moderation and reason are increasingly being elbowed out by well-financed fringe elements. Democrats, too, say they've been worn down. State Rep. Elaine Nekritz, who is voluntarily ending her 14-year legislative career, said she cried multiple times while talking to constituents hurt by the budget crisis. State Rep. Carol Sente said solving problems became tougher to do as the dynamics of the General Assembly changed, with more legislators from the far right or left. Many lawmakers blame this on gerrymandering, in which political districts are drawn up to be safely Democratic or Republican. Sente also tired of the constant campaigning. For those of us in competitive districts with races every 2 years, to spend 5 solid months every other year campaigning, working your butt off and eating drive-through meals once you win that battle, you want to make a difference, to legislate, compromise, and fix problems, Sente said. The impasse and the partisanship are cumulative, and it adds up. So over time, I think there is a threshold for everyone when they say, I need a break, or I'm done. In the Together Decatur column, Donette Beckett writes, "Recent lawnmower racing champ reigns from Decatur. Jason Brown races lawnmowers at up to 55 miles per hour." From Decatur, "Jason Brown said he liked racing his lawnmower as a child. Cutting loose was just as fun as cutting the grass. It's the first thing you want to do as a kid when you get on a mower," he said. "It is instinctive to pop a wheelie and go fast." His roaring good instincts paid off 30 years later. On September 2nd, Brown competed at the 2017 STABIL National Lawnmower Racing Series Nationals USLMRA Championship at River Bottom Raceway in Carlisle, Iowa. He won the SP class, a division Brown described as medium speed. "They go about 30 to 40 miles per hour. The top class may go 55, he said. A Decatur resident, Brown has raced other vehicles such as mini bikes, street stock cars, utility terrain vehicles, dirt bikes, and drag racing cars. He said he enjoys racing all of them, but finds lawnmowers to be exceptional. I'm more excited now than I was when I started," Brown said. Brown began racing modified lawnmowers 2 years ago. According to the U.S. Lawnmower Racing Association, Illinois has 40 racing chapters. Lawnmower racing has 10 classifications in speed. Brown races in three categories, but plans to expand his fleet of mowers. Along with the SP mower, he says he currently owns a simpler GPT and his fastest, the FXT. Jeff Krause often travels with Brown to racing tracks throughout the Midwest, including Missouri, Iowa, and Oklahoma. He watched as Brown raced during the championship. "In his SP class, it puts out about 30 horses," Krause said about the winner mower and its driver, "and he won it all. He also took home the most points of the season, so he is a national champ." The mowers Brown and Krause race have engines with various horsepower and a wide range of wheelbases. The mowers are updated with go-kart components. Cutting blades must be removed. "It is a cross between a go-kart and a mower," Brown said. Brown's father, Charlie, often races with his son at their home track in Cerro Gordo Speedway. "This is something we can do together," the elder Brown said. "He is 40 and I'm nearly 60, and we are still playing together." Lawnmower racers describe the atmosphere on race days as reminiscent of a family reunion with friendly competitors ready to lend a motor part to those in need. Racers do not compete for money. Brown sees this as a positive. "They say it is a gentleman's sport," he said. "Money makes it corrupt." The mowers can reach high speeds, similar to the mini bikes the family has driven. "But when you fall down on them, it hurts," Charlie said. "Mowers are a little easier on you." Lawnmower racing requires safety equipment such as a helmet, neck brace, long sleeves, and gloves. Charlie said racing lawnmowers has other appeals. Price is one factor. The vehicles are easy to put together. "People always have lawnmowers and parts," he said. "When you get up there in the class and power, you have to get professional parts." Brown often races at Cerro Gordo Speedway in a simpler mower without bold colors or intimidating pieces. The mower has a stock motor with an everyday lawnmower body. "I race with this just to mess with people," he said. "Far away, it looks like a lawnmower." And the sidebar to this article notes, "Do you know a person of a story that exemplifies the best of Decatur? Contact Donette Beckett at 217-421-6983 or dbeckett@herald-review.com. And on the local page, county board aims to fill Baxter's spot in November. New official to be elected by November 9th. Ryan Voiles writes from Decatur, "Macon County Board officials are hoping to fill the vacancy left by the death of John Baxter by their November 9th meeting. Letters were sent Friday to leaders of both the Macon County Democrat and Republican parties asking for recommendations for who should fill the seat. If you have someone in mind who would be interested in the vacancy, please notify me as soon as possible so I can make my decision and the appointment can be included on the board agenda, said the letter signed by Board Chairman Jay Dunn. The letters were provided to the Herald and Review on Friday afternoon. By state statute, the county has 60 days from when the letters went out to fill the vacancy. Baxter, who died Monday, September 11th, was appointed to the board in 2008 and was unopposed in his most recent re-election in 2014. Along with serving on the board, the former public defender also served for years as chairman of the county's Justice Committee. The appointee would serve the last of Baxter's term, which is set to expire after next November's election. Since Baxter was a Democrat, the seat is expected to be filled by one as well, despite the letter being sent to leaders of both parties. With the vacancy, the board has 10 Democrats and 10 Republicans. Whomever does fill the seat will have big shoes to fill, as Baxter's knowledge and sense of humor made him one of the most likable members of the county board. He's going to be dearly missed, said board member Kevin Meacham, who served alongside Baxter in County District 1. For Tim Dudley, vice chairman of the board and fellow Democrat, few people have expressed such a passion for the board as much as Baxter did during his lifetime. He specifically noted a time when Baxter came to a meeting in a wheelchair, pushed by his wife, just so he would not miss it. That was the dedication John had to this county, even though he didn't feel right and probably shouldn't have even been there, Dudley said. Next, contract could keep birds away. From Decatur. The Decatur City Council will consider tonight a $73,500 contract with Soul's Bird Repellent Company to keep birds away from downtown Decatur and the surrounding area for the next 3 years. The city has contracted with the company for decades to prevent large amounts of birds, such as starlings, from congregating downtown and causing problems for residents and businesses. The purpose of controlling the birds is to minimize the health-related problems, cleanup costs, and nuisances that can be associated with high numbers of birds flocking or roosting in the area, city staff wrote in a memo to the council. The new agreement expands the area covered by the contract to include the Decatur Civic Center, downtown post office, Decatur Public Library, bus depot, and parking garage C at Wood and Franklin. In 2005, owner James Soles was featured in the Chicago Tribune as someone very effective at his trade, for reasons unknown. "I don't know what he does. They just fly away, and they don't come back," the newspaper quoted former Mayor Paul Osborne as saying at the time. A representative for the company could not be reached for comment in time for this story. Deputy City Manager Billy Tyus and Public Works Director Rick Marley acknowledge the company has never shared with the city its methods. Marley said staff in the Public Works Department have been able to figure it out, but Marley said he did not want to disrespect claims of propriety. And the article notes, if you go, the Decatur City Council meets at 5:30 p.m. tonight in the Council Chambers, 3rd floor, Decatur Civic Center, 1 Gary K. Anderson Plaza. There are several photographs on the local page with a short notation, "Doggy Dip." Above, Max and her owner, Marsha Leon, enjoyed the dip in the pool at Timber Cove Apartments in Decatur. Timber Cove Apartments in Decatur opened its pool before it was drained to the dogs for a pool party to end summer. And there's a photograph also of Carrie Holderby trying to get her dog named Master Jedi into the pool. And one more photograph, Nova and his owner, Melissa Kramer, enjoying the dip in the pool. The final article on the local page, this is from 100 Reasons to Love the Decatur Area. Decatur, the birthplace of Alison Krauss. Before she was a child prodigy, before she was blazing a trail for the national popularity of a music genre, and before she became the Grammy's most awarded female artist in history, Alison Krauss was born in Decatur. The woman who helped bring Americana music into the mainstream didn't spend much time here, with her family moving to Champaign a couple of years after her birth. She began taking classical music at age 5 and switched to bluegrass music. At age 8, she placed 4th in a competition at the Champaign County Fair, competed at the Illinois State Fair when she was 10, and the next year won the Illinois State Fiddle Championship at age 11, and being named Most Promising Fiddler in the Midwest by the Society for the Preservation of Bluegrass in America. She signed her first recording contract when she was 14. When she was 18, she earned her first Grammy nomination, 1989's Two Highways. She became a member of the Grand Ole Opry when she was 22. She was featured an Oscar-nominated movie soundtrack work on Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And Cold Mountain. She's topped the country charts with albums 3 times and charted in the top 10 an additional 9 times. Grammy Album of the Year, Raising Sand, featuring Krauss and former Led Zeppelin singer Robert Plant, reached the top of the Billboard album chart, but stopped at number 2 on the country chart. She's been nominated for 42 Grammy Awards, winning 27. She is tied with Quincy Jones as the most awarded living recipient. Classical conductor George Schulte, who holds the record for most wins with 31. She is the most awarded singer and the most awarded female artist in Grammy history. And from the dialogue page, what others are saying. This is from the Chicago Tribune. War is sometimes a mistake. Is there a more painful game of what if that Americans could play than to wonder what the 1960s and today would look like if the United States had avoided military catastrophe in Vietnam? The pivotal moment may have been in early 1965 when President Lyndon Johnson realized he was trapped in the early days of an escalating war the United States probably couldn't win. He knew the intensifying conflict would distract him from his prized agenda of creating the great society at home. But he also felt he had no choice but to proceed, because he'd won election in 1964 to a full term as president by promising to lick the North. I feel like a jackass caught in a Texas hailstorm. I can't run, I can't hide, and I can't make it stop, he's quoted as saying in Ken Burns' gripping new documentary series, The Vietnam War. Oh, the power of hindsight and the tragedy of hubris. Both are powerfully demonstrated in the 10-part, 18-hour PBS documentary series that began airing Sunday. Burns, co-director Lynn Novick, and their team worked for 10 years to tell the story, interviewing dozens of witnesses, including combatants on both sides. It was worth the effort. One of the most important points the series makes is that Johnson clearly understood the risk of beginning a major bombing campaign in the North and committing U.S. ground troops to the conflict. If only he'd listened to his own taped telephone conversations, which Burns uses to strong effect. Ever eavesdrop on someone making a terrible decision? That's what watching the Vietnam War feels like. The background. In late 1964, the documentary explains, North Vietnam pulled off its first stunning battlefield victory of the war, sending Viet Cong troops deep into the south to Binh Gia, where they annihilated several companies of South Vietnamese Army Rangers, killing 200. 5 American military advisors died. Soon after, the North Vietnamese blew up a hotel occupied by American military personnel, killing 23. If the Viet Cong troops could penetrate so deeply into the South, this said something important about the war's trajectory. Johnson knew. In March 1965, he shared his concerns in a phone call with Senator Richard Russell of Georgia, who told the president there appeared to be no way out of Vietnam. Johnson responded, "A man can fight if he can see daylight down the road somewhere, but there ain't no daylight in Vietnam. There's not a bit." Yet Johnson chose to fight, unleashing Operation Rolling Thunder, a sustained bombing campaign, and ordering the first U.S. ground troops into the conflict. The war would last 10 more years. In all, more than 58,000 Americans would die, and several million Vietnamese. Burns said the purpose of their documentary wasn't to pass judgment or play what if, but to put the passage of time to his advantage as a documentary maker. After 40 years, the consequences are better understood, and once hidden details have been uncovered and studied. Also, with the U.S. and Vietnam now friendly, the filmmakers could interview some of the victors. Former Vietnamese soldiers who seemed comfortable telling their stories. Many Americans also participated. The Vietnam era was polarizing and it was agonizing, spawning political upheaval and a cultural revolution in the U.S. Burns believes the war unleashed an era of partisanship the nation reckons with today. In all, the Vietnam War provides enduring lessons, but also puzzles. How is it that 4 decades after the morass of Vietnam, America is 16 years into another long-running problematic war, this one in Afghanistan? What does that say about the significance of studying history? War is revealing, and human nature doesn't change, are how Burns answers those questions. Human nature superimposes itself on the seemingly random chaos of events that take place. By having historical awareness, you can probably have a better perspective on that moment. For that reason, among others, Vietnam is worth watching. Among the articles coming up this week, Herald and Review staff notes, Project Linus warms up for hurricane help. Project Linus is holding a day-long blanket-making event for hurricane relief. The idea is to make as many blankets as they can to reach the organization's national goal of 5,000 blankets for children and families affected by Hurricane Harvey in Texas and Hurricane Irma in Florida. The blankets are a comfort item as much as for warmth during trying times as the residents of these states start to rebuild their lives. Quilts and fleece blankets for children will be assembled by the blanketeers in the gymnasium at the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. For more than 2 decades, Project Linus blankets have been lovingly created, collected, and distributed to children in hospitals, shelters, social service agencies, or anywhere that a child might be in need of a big hug. Read more in Tuesday's paper. And Pipe Dreams theater season begins. The student actors from Millikan University's Pipe Dreams Studio Theater are beginning their season with a loud start. The first show for the Black Box Theater will be The Undeniable Sound of Right Now, beginning Friday, September 22nd, and running to Sunday, October 8th. Read more from staff writer Donette Beckett in Thursday's Arts and Entertainment section. And we'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review, September 18th, 2017. Please stay tuned.